Michael Crawford concludes reading from his autobiography. Parcel arrived safely.
In May 1986, the announcement was made to the press that I had been cast as the Phantom in Andrew Lloyd Webber's latest musical, The Phantom of the Opera. There were some understandable industry comments about the strange casting. This dramatic role was undoubtedly far removed from anything I'd done in the recent past. But Andrew and the American director, Hal Prince, gave me the chance. Thus began a new regimen of singing lessons, practicing 5 and 6 hours a day, and 2-hour sessions with voice coach Ian Adam every single day of the week for the next 2 months. The search for the look of the Phantom took up an enormous amount of time. I spent weeks consulting with Maria Bjornsson, our genius of costume and production design, and with Christopher Tucker, famed for his work on the film of The Elephant Man, who'd been commissioned to design the Phantom's hideous face. Chris experimented with every conceivable kind of makeup to overcome the physical restrictions imposed on us by the live production. My ears and nose had to be kept clear so I could hear the music and breathe freely, and my mouth had to be kept clear so that I could be completely understood when I sang. The idea of wearing a half mask was Maria's, and it solved all our problems, save one. The Phantom was a romantic figure, and the exposed side of my face had to be appealing to the audience. No small feat. So in addition to the foam latex pieces needed for the Phantom's skull, lips, cheekbones and deformities, Chris designed some additional prosthesis to straighten my nose, giving the exposed side a Valentino look. There were some concerns about the amount of time it took to apply all the makeup. It originally took 2 hours to prepare, and we quickly learned that the prosthetic pieces had to fit like a second skin, because in the early days the glue didn't hold well, and the bottom lip was often loose. I dreaded Sarah Brightman, who played Christine, walking away after our big kiss, wearing my lip. Then my face had to be painted and highlighted, and the makeup blow-dried and powdered to prevent the foundation from cracking. An application of lubricating jelly to give the face a translucent glow and to keep the makeup from looking too powdery completed the process. Rehearsals for The Phantom of the Opera were a very different experience for me. I was isolated from the rest of the company much of the time, working with an accompanist on voice and movement for 5 or 6 weeks. Later on, whenever there was a scene or a run-through, I was called in to join the others, adding my character to the scene. It was almost as if I was outside the show, not of it, but it worked rather well simply because of the nature of the role I was playing. Although the Phantom is only on stage for about 35 minutes, his invisible presence must suffuse the entire theatre while the show is going on. Hal Prince gave me great leeway in the development of the character. He envisioned the show as a romance on a grand scale, rather than simply the horror tale it had become over the decades through film versions. And he saw the Phantom himself as a mysterious ideal, sophisticated, sensual and seductive. I felt there had to be an inherent nobility about the man, along with an exquisite vulnerability and the passionate pride that is his ultimate undoing. He is, in sum, an extraordinary man, with all the qualities that word suggests. Unique, gifted, monstrous, remarkable. Maria Bjornsson was Hal's collaborative equal from day one of the production, and from the very beginning she was interested in my input on costuming the Phantom. Because the Phantom is masked and thereby limited to the use of his hands and body movements to communicate his unspoken love to the girl and to the audience, the costuming provided an essential aid to his expression. The cut of his waistcoat influenced the way he stood and sat, and the stiffness of the upper body emphasized his air of pride and nobility. I recalled my grandfather Monty's high lace-up work boots. I always thought there was a slightly pathetic look about them, and I had a pair made up for me to wear. They were the perfect thing, I thought, to accentuate the Phantom's inner vulnerability. I was particularly thrilled with my theatrically grotesque appearance, and absolutely convinced that even my friends wouldn't recognize me. I was quickly disabused of that theory while rushing down the stairs in the full horror of my makeup to a dress rehearsal. Someone passed me on the stairwell and said casually, "Hello, Michael, how are you?" "I'm sorry," I murmured in a hurry. "Joss Ackland," he reminded me. "Joss, I'm sorry," I said. I didn't recognize you." And we both burst out laughing at the irony of the situation. When we began our previews, we were still experiencing more than the usual technical snags. Hardly surprising in view of the complex network of machinery and computers we were using to produce the breathtaking special effects. My own particular cross was the ornate gondola that ferries the Phantom round his subterranean haunt. It was navigated from the wings by a remote control device, not unlike the way a model car is operated. I think it is safe to say that it was none too reliable. Our stage manager, however, insisted that the system had great potential and we should stick with it. So, for the first time in my life, I decided to keep my mouth shut. It was the dumbest decision I ever made. I recall the evening of our first public preview. The gondola halted right on the mark. I got out, walked around it, plucking Sarah's hand in midair, pulling her out of the boat and passed me into position for our next scene. Her eyes suddenly widened in a warning glance, and I was horrified to see the gondola was following me around like some kind of giant pet. Whenever I stopped, it butted me on the backside. I grabbed the bow to lift the boat back into position, hopefully before the audience became aware of what was happening and started to laugh. The last thing we wanted to do was break the mood of the moment. Finally, I managed to heave it into place, but it was so heavy that I found myself completely out of breath, just as I started to sing Music of the Night. After the show, I heard all sorts of comments from well-wishers about the number. "Ah, the feeling," said one friend, "the emotion you put into that song." Every one of the previews was a nightmare. I would step on the boat and wonder what was in store. Would the boat stop on the mark tonight? Or would we end up across the road at the Haymarket Theatre in the middle of a Peter O'Toole soliloquy? There were other technical problems as well. At one memorable preview, Sarah and I had just embarked on the final confrontation scene in the Phantom's lair. On stage, the organ was programmed to slide alongside me from stage left, and the Phantom Throne was cued to appear from stage right. The computer-driven candles had risen through the stage, and the trapdoors, all 136 of them, had closed tight. That was my cue to fling Sarah into the middle of the stage. But just as I did, all the trapdoors opened up again. We had to weave our way around them, not an easy task when the stage is covered in a fog of dry ice. To add to the chaos, the massive Don Juan bed, a prop from the previous scene, rumbled back onto the stage again, and the organ, which had suddenly developed a mind of its own, rolled off. Sarah was rooted to the floor. I couldn't tell if she was acting or panicking. I walked towards her slowly, more cat-like than usual, lifting each foot carefully before gingerly setting it down again, insinuating my way through the sea of candles that kept popping up and down in a kind of mad phallic display. Midway across the stage, unfortunately, I chose exactly the wrong place to stop and felt one of those 8-inch candles thrust its way up my trouser leg. For the moment, I was trapped. I think I hopped around a bit in the effort to free myself. The bulb at the end of the candle was lit and it burned my calf. Clear at last, I continued to pussyfoot my way across to Sarah. At precisely that moment, some unseen anarchist hand took control of our computer system and everything on stage went completely mad. The throne slid into the wings, then came back on again, and then the bed popped in and out like a cuckoo clock. The portcullis was due to descend as well, and if any of us were standing in the wrong place, he or she would most certainly have been pierced straight through the head. At last, one of the crew had the presence of mind to pull the bed off the stage with his bare hands. All the trap doors closed again, and a degree of order was restored. Thankfully, most of the kinks were ironed out by the time we opened at Her Majesty's Theatre on October the 9th, 1986. If we had any questions about what we'd done that evening, they were quickly answered by the cheering, stamping, standing ovation that lasted nearly 10 minutes. It was Boo Lay, the late Evelyn Lay, was Boo to everyone in the theatre, who told me, "Never turn your back on success." Her advice was golden for me, and after London, I went on to play the Phantom in New York and Los Angeles. Nowadays, actors will join a show only for a limited period of time. The prevailing thought seems to be that staying on too long in a show can interfere with a performer's career. There is always, of course, the challenge of trying to keep the character fresh through countless performances. Each day you have to dig deep into your emotions, and your powers of concentration have got to be such that the ideas and images you use to create the part come alive inside you time and time again. You'll often hear members of a company in a long-running production refer to themselves as a family. It may sound overdone to the outsider, but the comparison is apt. And depending upon the depth and endurance of your shared experiences, it can be a terrible wrench to have to say goodbye when you finally do part company. You'll probably run into each other again, somewhere, sometime, but it will never again be quite the same. When I left the Los Angeles production of Phantom, I couldn't stay at home because I knew I'd start clock watching, and that you mustn't do. So I got in a car and I drove with my daughter Lucy and my friend Sue across America from coast to coast. It was a project designed to completely absorb my mind and concentration. We arrived in Florida exactly 1 week later. I looked at my watch. It was 4:20 on a Sunday afternoon, 1:30 p.m. on the West Coast. The company should just be arriving, putting their makeup on, warming up. I couldn't help myself. I had to make contact with my family in Los Angeles again. I picked up the phone, called the backstage office, and spoke to the company manager. "It's Michael," I told him. "I miss you all." "Michael?" he asked. "Michael who?"